And then it is said that meditation upon lofty spiritual ideations, certain kinds of meditation, stir up the sleeping layers of Kundalini at the base of the spine. And in response to the hyperactivity here, this Kundalini fire is drawn up into the brain. That also makes it more sensitive, stimulates it. So you see, prana, electromagnetic energy, and the serpent fire from the body get drawn up into the brain in meditation, and this makes it more sensitive. And as I think we have found in earlier talks on this subject, chiefly the pituitary and pineal glands. One question I have here goes back to an earlier talk on symbolism. When I ventured to say that the number 12, when introduced to an allegorical narrative, can be interpreted as referring to the 12 signs of the zodiac and their particular qualities, powers, attributes, and capacities in man. In illustration, I just referred, I didn't have the full particulars with me, I referred en passant to the 12 tribes of Judah and the 12 heads of the tribe. And I said, well, these have astrological significance. Well, now I brought with me an answer to your question, the details. Because, you know, in Genesis 49, the dying Jacob, the forefather, gave these correspondences, apparently, to his sons. And he described each one of his family in astrological terms, 12 in number. It's very strange. Listen. Reuben, he said, unstable as water. Aquarius. Simon and Levi, a strong fraternal association. Gemini. Judah, the strong lion of his tribe. The lion's whelp, he calls him, Leo. The idea is supported, you see. Zebulun, he shall dwell at the haven of the sea, Pisces. Issachar, a strong ass. Poor Issachar, a strong ass, couching down and therefore associated with stables and byres, where the cattle live. But he calls him a strong ass. Stubborn, you see, stubborn. And astrologers refer that to Taurus. Then Dan, he said, his father said, Dan is a serpent, an adder in the path that biteth, he said. Virgo, Scorpio. Scorpio particularly. I don't agree quite with Virgo there, I'll cross it out. Whoever did this. Scorpio, I think. Stinging Scorpio. Naphtali. What does he say about his son Naphtali? He said, a hind, a deer let loose. Capricorn. Benjamin. Ravenous, he said. He said, Benjamin is ravenous. Cancer. Asher, whose bread shall be fat. This doesn't seem to fit too well for me, but I'm quoting Libra, the balance. Joseph, he said of Joseph, his bow abode lived in strength. Got it? Joseph, his bow abode in strength. Sagittarius. Gad, his troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Aries, ruled by Mars. Last one of all, the only girl, remember, there's only one girl in the 12 children of Jacob at the time he died. She was called Dinah, the only daughter of Jacob. And up to a time in the story, she was unmarried. So, Virgo. Now, if this is an accident, it's more difficult to believe than if there is some hidden revelation there by means of symbol. I think so. And you know, there is a tradition that the 12 tribes and their patriarchs all had their own banners, flags, and each had its astrological sign on its own banner, according to Jacob's definition, not only of the tribe, but the future. Read it for yourselves, friends, and see. It's Genesis 49. Interesting study. Whether there were 12 or not is open to dispute. Historically, they can't all be actually pinpointed. They're named in the Bible, at any rate. Supporting, rather, the idea that many of the books of the Bible and other scriptures really are revelations of deep occult wisdom, power-bestowing knowledge under the veil of allegory and symbol. And so you find, if you study alchemy, the alchemy of the Middle Ages. There the supposed transmutation of base metals, particularly lead, into gold passes through 12 stages, which are clearly defined in alchemical works. Of course, that wasn't the purpose of alchemy. It was again a possible veil for a deep spiritual wisdom, dangerous to give out under the growing domination of Christian theology at the time and the power of the Inquisition. And so, all that strange and massive symbology of the philosophers and the alchemists of the Middle Ages. So when you open their books, you're astounded. Till you look closely, then you quickly see, here is a list of symbols, here are copies of presentations of ancient ideas. I'll mention the 12 stages which the alchemists gave in the transmutation, supposedly of metal into gold, really of the base qualities of human nature, into pure wisdom. It's a human regeneration. And if you look at the symbols, you'll see how clearly this is portrayed. For example, the commonest of all the symbols is the god Mercury, with his caduceus, a perfect representation of Kundalini. Some of the retorts are built to look like the caduceus of the Egyptian mist, of the Greek mysteries, perfectly representing the triple currents of Kundalini. Well, this is what they say. I'll name them, it won't take your time. Stages are, first, Aries, calcination. expulsion of purification by the fire of aspiration. First step. Next, Taurus. The achievement of one-pointedness. Gemini. Steadfastness. The condition of becoming firm. They call it fixation. Cancer. Dissolution. To universalize the personality. Dissolve it. Leo. Ingestion. To perfect the mind in wisdom and imagination. Virgo. The release of the soul from its involvement in bodily limitation. Libra in alchemy, sublimation, the refining of elemental bodies, the increasing of the vibratory harmonies of the soul, the body and soul. Scorpio, separation, by which the spiritual and material elements of man are separated. Sagittarius, the burning away of the dross, the soul becomes free of the external body. Capricorn, the goat. They say the conversion of organic substance into new compounds. And one of the books I see finds the building of the golden man. It's the golden man that the alchemists were seeking to build. That is to say, to the pure Buddhic consciousness to be fully aroused and all the baser parts of human nature to be transmuted into that glory. The golden man. Wonderful thought. Then Aquarius, adeptship. And finally, Pisces. Immortality. Buddhahood. Dear friends, I could go on quite a long time. I could just give you one more. The labors of Hercules, 12 in number. It's not an accident. If you take those 12 labors, which Hercules voluntarily undertook to carry out, you see the initiate going round life after life. Perhaps more quickly, the process of developing the faculties and powers represented by the zodiac, 12 in number. He slays the Nemean lion, Leo, and so on. Rather interesting. I recommend that to you as a study. Take the 12 labors of Hercules and work them out in terms of spiritual development, always in accordance with the symbolism. You remember how wonderfully Hercules cleared out the Augean stables. There were stables in which horses had been, cattle had been kept for generations, never cleaned out. And so the stables were full. And he was ordered to clean them out, a tremendous task. How did he do it? I've mentioned this before. What did he do? Dig? No. He found a spring higher up. And he knocked a hole in the back of the stables, diverted the water of the stream so that it flowed through naturally and washed away all the accretion. Aquarius. Water, water. And thus, throughout the mythology and scriptures of ancient people, read with a discerning, intuitive mind, it is possible to discover deep and secret and power-bestowing knowledge. Conceal, because it is dangerous, power bestowing nothing. That leads me, I see, though I didn't plan it, What is, another question you've sent up, what is the one grand and royal secret? Masonic term, by the way, somebody's yours. What is the one grand and royal secret behind the symbolical veils used by the alchemists with their suns, moons, Mercury, and the furnace and the fire by which lead is supposed to be transmuted into gold? I've answered that now, I find. The secret is, of course, the fire of creation, the serpent fire, Kundalini Shakti, symbolized by the caduceus in the hand of the god Hermes, and by the sign, where it's drawn, of the planet Mercury. Since you ask me, in symbolism, the sun represents the monad and the positive, the moon, the personality, the negative. When they're joined, as they are, successful yoga. Sun also, pingala, the pituitary gland. Moon, pineal gland. Mercury, sushumna. The furnace, what's the furnace? Always in this talk are the fire philosophers, therefore. Why? The serpent fire, resident at the base of the spine of man, in the Muladhara Chakra. There the creative fire is stored in man. That's the furnace, the alchemical furnace in our bodies. And by yoga, the mystical alchemy is performed of changing by this fire, transmuting and sublimating all that is base in man into all that is pure and glorious, fine gold. Comes out in the Bible, you know, also, not only in alchemy, friend. Don't you remember how finally Moses managed to win freedom for the Israelites from bondage in Egypt? How did he do it? The 12 plagues didn't do it. They were bad enough. But the Pharaoh hardened his heart every time. So last of all, an occult power had to be shown. And so Moses and Aaron were brought into the presence of the Pharaoh himself and his magicians. And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, cast down your rod. What happened? The rod turned into a serpent. The rod in symbolism is always the spinal cord. All perpendiculars, trunks of trees, uprights of crosses, all of these upright, spinal cord. In this human interpretation, the rod then was transmuted and changed into a serpent. Then Pharaoh said, I let you go. Translated, the soul, the Israelites, win freedom from the bondage of the flesh, Egypt, by means of turning the rod into a serpent. It's all there, friend. It's all there. The Israelites in the desert, you remember afterwards, they become afflicted with a serious disease, possibly the social disease. What happened? Moses constructed a cross with a brazen serpent on it, held it up above them. They were cured magically. The cross sacrifice, the serpent, fire elevated, freeing man from the wilderness state of consciousness. Now I'm stopped there. We'll have our break. One that I'm asked several times is, can meditation ever be dangerous? Important and valuable question, I think. First, may I say that the group meditation, which we try to do together on Sunday mornings, is, as far as I know, safe. Having led groups for 20 or 30 years by this method, and never having had one slightest experience or episode of trouble, I consider it to be quite safe. Otherwise, of course, I wouldn't do it with any group. All departures from the normal can, I suppose, be dangerous. And to try and force one's consciousness and one's brain to express it beyond the normal must have inherent difficulties, if not dangers. May I say here, as I have so often said to those who've asked me this question, some of you, pain is the great safeguard. Never go on meditating if you feel a pain in the head. That's nature's warning. You're straining your brain. This process I've been describing is proving a little too much at the time. Rest. Practice relaxation and meditate on peace or some other quietening subject, and not upon an arousing topic like the spirit in me is one with the spirit in all. I am that, that am I. That overdone, misused, could, I must admit, be dangerous. And the pathway of hastened progress is strewn with the wrecks of those who have failed. And all the failures are due to, nearly all of them, unwisdom in carrying out the process. The soul awakens, the person is alive, the will is on fire, and they cannot rest anymore and continue in their state of enslavement to the body and fate and ignorance. And so they determine to know. And they say the knowledge is within them, and they seek to penetrate with all the power they have to the knowledge which is within. Overdone, unwisely done, long over long, too much, yes, dangerous. The various chakras are, for example, subject to strain and distortion, which can affect consciousness. I know one person whose Brahmarandra chakram at the crown of the head was permanently and irremediably distorted, so that she became slightly subnormal. But then this person used to meditate every hour, on the hour, all through the day, with all the force at her command. So eagerly did she aspire to the spiritual heights. Then there are other dangers. Breathing exercises, which are accompanied by concentration on one of the chakras and parts of the body. These are dangerous. These are dangerous. Particularly, by the by, particularly the solar plexus. May I go on record as saying, since you've asked me, never meditate upon the solar plexus. Yogis will come round and advise it, and other teachers, and say, this will awaken clairvoyance for you. And together with certain breathing exercises, they rupture the protection which is here, and the person becomes a prey to the influences of the corresponding lower astral plane. It's very dangerous indeed. The rule in Aryan, that's fifth race occultism, is never below the heart. Never meditate below the heart. I find myself inclined to warn also against all breathing exercises. Partly because I've consulted so many times by people who under some yogic guidance have practiced strange breathing exercises, and these have upset their psychology and rendered them, brought them into grave difficulty. There's no need for these things, friends. Forget the body and identify with the spiritual self. And the less we're aware of our body in meditation, the sooner we escape from it and enter into higher consciousness, the better. The great rule is privacy, regular continuance, complete relaxation of the body, spine erect, and then eyes closed if you like, meditate on spiritual truths. If you follow that, no harm will come, especially if you stop the moment there's pain. Pain is sometimes caused by the fact that in some part of the body the relaxation is imperfect or the posture has failed. For example, the head can get over on one side or forwards, or if you're reaching up, upwards. Well, any such change of the posture of the spine is dangerous. Very often will produce a pain. And of course, Laya Yoga, or Kundalini Yoga, is dangerous. And any attempt to arouse the Kundalini into action, unless a senior in occultism, or better still, an adept is beside you, this is very dangerous indeed. Very. Then not only a psychological and mental disturbance, you know, and associated troubles, but delusions. These really are another very grave danger. Meditation can give one a sense of power, can awaken one's vision, so that one sees more than other people see. One gets absorbed in that, away from the central issue, which is to realize the divine self, and that one with the self in all. Nothing else at all. So that in the yoga instructions generally, we are all warned against psychic experiences and psychic development. Why? Because they distract the attention away from the one central objective, which is to be able to say in full realization, as did our Lord, I and my Father are one. That's all. That's the sole objective. Yoga, hence the name yoga. So every departure from the normal is fraught with danger. This need not deter us, but there are fairly clearly stated rules let us follow them. Then all will likely be well. Thank you for that question. Can be the best ways of spreading theosophy. What do you consider to be the best ways of spreading theosophy? And I've had to orient my thought to another field. And I, with Sandra, have drawn up a few ideas about how to spread theosophy. Well, I always say by three means. Lives, literature, lectures. You notice the order? In my mind, the order of importance. One's life. The way one lives amongst one's fellows. The way one is seen by one's fellow. All of this plays its part. I don't know whether I dare be personal, may I? And introduce a personal note, not in self-praise, praise of theosophy. I was very, very ill about 12 years ago and given up. And I lay in very great pain. And the sister nurse stood beside me. She's nursing me all the time. And she stood there looking at me. So I opened my eyes and I said, "What is it, sister?" She said, "Mr. Hudson," she said. It's not self-praise. "Mr. Hudson, I know now that you are a man who has found his own peace," which surprised me. "What is that peace?" Well, of course I answered theosophy and disclaimed any personal attributes, whatever, as far as I could talk, and gave her books eventually. But I saw then, as I see now, however imperfectly I live it out, I know I do, how much our lives, our very posture, mental and physical, our appearance, our way of living, our approach to each other, all of that, I'm inclined to think, is of first importance. First importance. What we are. What else? How else? Well, then, literature and lectures, obviously. Well, a profound conviction born of study, born of knowledge attained, and of intuitive recognition of truth. This is another way in one's life of spreading the gospel. Even if one never says a word. Then something else. Skill about introducing theosophy into conversation. So much harm is done by the unwise introduction of all these subjects we're studying into conversation with people who can only regard them as delusion and the individual as nearly insane. Does such harm, you see? "Oh, he's a theosophist. Oh, I see." So I put skill in deciding when to include theosophy in personal conversation and when not to do so. For myself, I had a good look at myself then, which is a good thing, and I find, as far as I know, I never introduce theosophy into personal conversations. unless I'm asked. Never. I never introduce it. Keep off it. Unless I'm asked. And the real person who really needs it, who can be guided and helped by, feel something, and they will ask you. Otherwise, be careful. Be careful. Then in our sections, in our lodges, and in our society, I think, this is personal opinion, let us guard against authoritarianism in any form whatever. You know my feeling about that by my opening remarks. For me, from the first moment I discovered it, nearly 60 years ago, the great appeal of theosophy was, and the Theosophical Society was, the freedom which it gave to all its members. There isn't one dogma to be found in the whole great body of theosophical relationship between the organization and its members. I love that. I go with Thales of Miletus. Nothing is of any value without freedom. So I think we can help by watching that and preserving it in ourselves especially and in our movements. Watch against any kind of authoritarianism. It's liable to come up because we're all human. As Tacitus said, the old Roman historian, domination is the ruling passion of man. Don't have it in your lodge, in your section, in our society. If you do, we become a sect. Then the world sees a sect instead of an absolutely unique movement in which freedom is granted. A rarity in the world, remember, especially if you look at world religions. And you've noticed what's been happening in one sect in the last 3 weeks. How serious. It can split the sect, the denomination asunder by a papal announcement. None of that in the Theosophical Society. I must answer you that. Then our literature. Spread it as far as possible. Always wisely. Some people always carry a brief statement of what theosophy is in their purses, or on their persons. And if it should come up, then they can say, well, here it is. And I notice a move as I travel about the world now, the lodges are trying, it's difficult, to have little displays of books outside their doors, their lodge entrances. You know? Some, our own lodge in Auckland now has its own book depot, and outside a very nice window with all our books and the most attractive looking books displayed. People come in. They're doing that in the Australian lodges, I noticed too, to have a bookshop. I've added, I see, enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. This I'd like to illustrate by a story. I said, didn't I, before we retired, or just now rather, that everything has its dangers in it, if misused. Here is this story about enthusiasm. It is told about the American ambassadress to Italy of some time ago, Mrs. Claire Booth Luce. She was a very ardent Catholic, Roman Catholic, and she thought Roman Catholicism is the thing for all humanity, when on all occasions, I presume suitable and unsuitable, she went in for propaganda of Roman Catholicism. Well, then she became appointed, didn't she, as ambassadress to Italy. And of course took up her residence in Rome. And in due course, being an ardent Roman Catholic, she was, and because of her office, she was granted an audience of the Pope. And the secretary took her in, and introduced her, and left them as is the custom. The usual half an hour granted for such audiences passed. And so the secretary thought, well, perhaps this is going on too long for His Holiness. I'd better see if she should terminate the conversation. So he opened the door. And he was just in time to hear the Pope say, "But Mrs. Luce, I am a Catholic." Wise enthusiasm. Well then, thus, let us, each one of us, in answer to your question, be a good representative of the society, of the great wisdom. Our appearance, our manners, our speech, and our relationships with our fellow men. Expressive, I suppose you would say, of our first object. Form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of man without distinction. And for me, of course, our marching orders have been stated by a great adept as something. It's not a dogma. In the very early days of the society, an adept communication was received. And in this letter, these words were found. "We have to popularize a knowledge of theosophy." And that seems to me our marching orders. And popularize does not mean to cheapen, but lucidly to expound. So perhaps by these methods we may, in answer to your question, spread theosophy. I've just received, by the by, the annual report of the National President of the American Section. It's a most wonderful report. Large numbers of members, new members during the year. A large percentage of them below the age of 35. Very, very large. Thousands of dollars of book sales. And the new Quest book series, under which much of our literature is now published in paperback, is being received by dealers and put on the bookstalls of the nation. And the sales are, I'll use a slang term, rocketing, according to her. So our literature is being spread abroad there. The society is growing. You only have to be there and work there and be with them to feel this spirit of enthusiasm and dedicated service and profound belief in theosophy as one of the great solutions to the pressing problems besetting mankind. I think I only have one more you've sent me. I hope I won't keep you too long. It's the person been talking to me about Krishnamurti. He's near here, as you know. I've been at Sarn and I've been to hear him. And what have I... The question is worded, "Would you care to comment upon the work of Krishnamurti?" He has now risen entirely by his own efforts, unaided by any organization or person, to such a height that a great many people now regard him as a great teacher. And it is said of him that he is unique among spiritual leaders in the world today, and that many thousands of people from all walks of life have been uplifted and spiritually reborn through his teachings. And certainly when I got to Sanand the other day, there were 800 to 1,000 people there from all over the world. Many of our American friends and Adyar and Hume, other English and other friends, there they were. And in the simplest possible manner, he came onto the stage, sat quiet a little, without notes, meditated with us, really, not in yoga, but ruminated upon life and human life, and in a quite illuminating manner. He talked to us about the problem of fear in human nature, and he tried to analyze its causes and why we should be afraid of anything. And it's a unique approach, but I must say I found it very interesting. Then he talked about love and its importance. Then he talked about the limiting effect of too many habits, both physical and mental, and how one wants to be able to approach life as freely as possible. One of his books says, "Free Life in Freedom." Well, as you know, when he was a young boy, very young little Indian boy, if you ever go to Adyar or India, you'll see a whole lot of little boys running around. Some of them undernourished and not particularly clean and not well dressed, and they're running about. And a number of them went at Adyar, and being a lover of young people, C.W. Leadbeater used to take them with him into the sea, bathing. And he picked up this young boy on his shoulders and went into the sea and eventually taught him to swim. And as he held him there, it dawned upon him, by his occult perceptions, that here is an advanced egger. Very wonderful prophecy, because it's proving to be absolutely true, that he has a mission before the world. Well, they then took this boy and taught him to be clean, educated him, dressed him, brought him to the West, and did every mortal thing without limit to help him to fulfill his mission. And it was felt by them in their inner experiences that under these conditions he could be a vehicle for one greater than himself. I knew him very well about little after that time. When he came to England, it fell to my very good fortune to be within the group of people with whom he lived. We knew each other well. He was very kind. And then he started his camps in Oman. And I went to many of them. And I wish to give you my testimony for what it is worth, that I have witnessed Krishnamurti and heard him overshadowed by a being far greater than himself. An unforgettable experience on more than one occasion. A campfire in a forest. Tiers of wooden seats. 2,000 to 3,000 people from all over the world. He lights the fire. Flames leap up. He chants a mantra to the god Agni. The Logos has fire. He goes to his seat. And we are all still. He begins to speak. And in those days, in the 1920s, he was beginning to be iconoclastic. Severely so. And suddenly, in the midst of that, he stops. His whole voice changes. His manner changes. And he begins to speak of love and the pathway of love and the way of service through love in a most beautiful, constructive group of sentences. Then he's seated. And those 2,000 to 3,000 people seat there also. And nobody wants to move. stillness pervaded us, and we all felt, and many saw, the overshadowing presence of a very great Lord. It's an unforgettable experience for me throughout my life. And I think on three such occasions at annual gatherings, this occurred, as well as when one was with him sometimes in personal life. Not an overshadowing, but a remarkable sense of the channelship through him. And even now, although he has publicly discounted or even denied the idea that he could be a vehicle for another, I don't think that denial really stands. Because if you go to hear him now, go perceptively. Much that he says may not be particularly appropriate to your own thinking, but be receptive and quiet, and large numbers of people still bear testimony to their perception of a spiritual effluence, an outflow of spiritual life through this Indian, slight figure of an Indian. I thought so again the other day. I wasn't thinking about it, but I felt it. Others too, with whom I talk. I have here a few words that I wrote the other day about this, which I offer in answer to you, friend, to your question. Thinking that he may be contributing to the thought of humanity, the ideas and ideals which will be normal and acceptable in the future, in future races, though also some practical today. In answer to a similar question, I wrote this. The absence of drama and of miracle in the present life of Krishnamurti is no proof that in both the presentation of certain ideas and the function of a channel for the Lord's outflowing and inspiration and blessing, Krishnamurti may, who is to know that he may not very well be serving according to an original plan? He may very well be serving according to the Lord's original plan. He, in his wisdom, may have decided to rely upon the transmission of ideas rather than the production of dramatic events and transcendent phenomena. Instead, a quiet, persuasive presentation of a group of ideas, appealing as much to the intuition as to the mind, may very well have been in the original plan. And this evidently is what is occurring. And my own impression is that, for what it's worth, that in this way, this undramatic way, buddhic, intuitive way, Krishnamurti may still continue to be touched by the Lord and on occasion used as a vehicle for his transcendent benediction to man. That's all I can really say in answer to your question. I'm now going on to read slowly to you descriptions of the yogic state in terms of consciousness. For example, the effect upon the yogi of even the first dawning of realization of man's spirit himself with God's spirit. The first experience, it is said, is to make available to his consciousness an increasing measure of universal light. Nearly all mystics bear testimony to this. The first experiences of light, which shines as if from a point within him. He or she find themselves as a center or focus of radiance within an illimitable ocean of light. Within, identical with the ocean, even though a center, which is part of it. And the devotee has only to quieten his mind, turn his consciousness towards the infinite, through the cube if you like, and at once he becomes aware of this life within himself. He does have an intellectual concept, however abstract, which is a sense of infinite supply, sense of infinite supply. At this level, the causal level, no negatives can enter. And therefore, there cannot possibly enter consciousness any idea of any absence or any limit or any want or any doubt or any death or any bereavement or any separation, because all is here in totality always. And so that's another experience, an infinite interior supply. Or I might say, the discovery within oneself of an inexhaustible wellspring of light and life. This is discovered with the realization of identity with that source. Always this strange sense of identity, unity, oneness. There aren't two. Every two is one. Never mind the paradoxes. Down here, we saw those when we were looking at our caterpillars and ourselves. Every two is a one. And in the inner consciousness, every opposition is unified into an interior oneness. All is one. One is all. I am that, that am I. That's part of the experience. So the yogi in success is at once in an interior state of fullness, of light, and life, and power, inexhaustible. Also in an interior state, realizing unity with the all-sufficing divine power, which isn't an external deity, but is within himself. He's emancipated from many theological ideas which have their truth and value in an effort to explain, but not in reality. There's no God above for the successful yogi. God within, I am that, that am I. So, he chants, I am he.